This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
If you crave technology that leads, if you appreciate design that inspires, if you want driving dynamics that excite, meet the one. The remarkable BMW 1 Series. Featuring front and rear parking sensors, cruise control, fully digital display with navigation and real-time traffic information, along with BMW's latest voice control intelligent personal assistant, all a standard. Meet the one with your own exclusive video consultation. Book yours today at BMW.ie.
The Masters on Sky Sports, now half price for 6 months. Witness all four unmissable days live from Augusta.
It's one of the grand theatres of the sporting world.
Oh, what a shot! You couldn't script this for a Hollywood movie.
The best place to watch all 4 days of the Masters live. To join or upgrade and get Sky Sports half price for 6 months, search Sky Sports Golf. New sports customers only. Standard pricing applies after 6 months. Further terms apply.
So hello and welcome to Pod's Own Country, the Yorkshire Post's political podcast. I'm Rob Parsons, the Yorkshire Post's political editor, and this week I've been left in charge of the podcast while Jerry Scott takes a well-earned week off from her Westminster correspondent duties. Never fear though, she'll be back next week. We've got a great guest for this week's episode in the shape of Lord Victor Adebowale, the chairman of the NHS Confederation, which represents the leaders of the health trusts who have been going above and beyond in the last year in the face of the worst public health crisis to grip the country in a century. I think it's fair to say that the pressure on the NHS is now finally easing after a brutal few months, but the breathing space the NHS now has offers an opportunity to reflect, I think, on what comes next for our health services and how we tackle some of those long-standing health inequalities that have plagued the country and our region for decades. But before we get on to that, I thought we could talk a bit to Greg Wright, the Yorkshire Post's deputy business editor, who you'll remember appeared on the podcast a few weeks ago, talking about his campaigning efforts on the loan charge and the terrible impact this has had on many people's lives. Now, Greg is actually working hard on another special report, which will appear in this weekend's edition of the Yorkshire Post, on another hugely important subject, which is the millions of people, and it is millions around the country, who've been excluded from government support during the pandemic. So let's bring in Greg now from sunny Ilkley. Greg, welcome back to the podcast.
I'm delighted to be back here, Rob. And it is quite a sunny day up in Ilkley. I think spring has finally arrived in Ilkley. So that's good news for all of us.
Good. I'm very glad to hear it. It's nice and sunny here in Leeds as well. So why don't you just tell us a bit about The Excluded? I imagine people might have heard of it. And I know, you know, Andy Burnham and other Northern leaders have been talking about it. But explain the scandal so far and sort of the background to it, if you can.
Yes, I mean, as we all know, over the last year, the UK economy has faced massive challenges due to the pandemic, and it's not been business as usual for millions of people. Due to lockdown, many businesses simply not been able to function. Now, in response to these massive changes in the economy and the fact that during lockdown, people could not trade, could not function as they would normally do, the government actually implemented a number of schemes to try and support the economy and stop people falling into poverty and also not being able to support their staff. Now, that has been welcomed by many people, and many business groups have welcomed the vast interventions that have been made by the government to support businesses and also to support employees in these difficult times. However, the fact remains that there are a group of people who have simply missed out. Now, these people have missed out often due to reasons which, to people looking on the outside, seem quite arbitrary. These are hardworking, honest people, taxpayers, who have been excluded from support which other people have benefited from. Now, according to Excluded UK, who are the campaigning group, they say 3 million people fall into this category, and they cover a wide variety of areas. I mean, it's an incredibly wide range of people. And this is because they don't fit into the support packages. Now, over the last year, we've seen support measures such as the Job Retention Scheme and the Self-Employment Income Support Scheme, along with benefits such as Universal Credit, which have been introduced by the government to help workers whose livelihoods have been impacted by the pandemic. However, this support doesn't cover some people. These include the newly employed, the newly self-employed, freelancers, directors of limited companies paid in dividends, and the self-employed with annual profits of more than £50,000. Now, there are some quite heartbreaking stories about this with people who have simply missed out on support altogether and simply cannot function. And as part of my investigation into this, I've spoken to quite a number of business people who are based in Yorkshire who have faced significant financial strain on the back of this. They include Rachel Flower from Hooby near Harrogate, who's one of the national founders of Excluded UK. And she actually told me that people have now got zero in their bank accounts and no food on the table. I've also spoken to Gina Miller, who is a well-known campaigner on behalf of people who want to reform the financial services system. And she's also told me various stories about the impact on people's well-being. It says people find it hard to pay for food and heating. What Excluded UK are basically calling for is for parity. If you're basically one of these groups who've missed out on support, they believe that a grant or extension to the existing COVID-19 schemes by the government could include those who have been denied support through no fault of their own. Now, when you speak to the government, what they do say is that in this difficult time, this crisis, they've done all they can to support jobs and livelihoods for the £350 billion package of support and the self-employed and the furlough schemes, which the government says are among the most generous in the whole world. I mean, they do acknowledge that it's not been possible to support everyone in the way they might want, but they say that funding is designed to target those who need it most and protect the taxpayer against fraud and abuse. It must be said there's a lot of support for people who have been excluded, though, and a lot of people from across the political divide who've got sort of backbench MPs across the party divide saying that more needs to be done to deal with these gaps in support. I've also spoken to members of the Federation of Small Business who still say that people are falling between the gaps. And what's happening in practical terms, these people basically have no savings. They're building up massive debts. So these business people who, before the pandemic, were successful and maybe just started on a successful enterprise, they've obeyed the law, they've stayed at home, they've protected the NHS, they've done the right thing. And as a result of all that, they're now facing significant financial problems. The problem also, from a practical perspective, is these people find it very hard to get back on their feet when the economy starts to recover. So you're going to have these up to 3 million people who are going to face significant long-term hardship and will continue to struggle in the future as well. So it's a massive dilemma for the government. When you speak to the government, there's no sign whatsoever of any movement in terms of supporting Excluded UK. You've still got the MPs battling hard to say that there are schemes that can be brought in that could support people. And it's very easy, they say, to avoid fraud if you have strong checks in place, which should be supportable. But I think the big issue here is a societal one. I mean, can we as a society allow such a large number of people simply to be left behind when all they've been guilty of, quite frankly, is falling between the gaps in support which have been set by government? And at the same time as they're doing this, they are doing all that they can to support their fellow citizens by not working, by staying at home, and by honouring all the sort of limits and sort of restrictions on personal behaviour which have been set during the pandemic. So it's a massive dilemma for government, but also a massive dilemma for society as a whole. And I think that many people, when we come out of this, will perhaps question why, in some areas, more support, more targeted support was not given to people who really did believe that despite all the issues the economy is facing and then the pressures on the public purse, they did believe that they deserved more support from their own government.
Yeah, absolutely. Are campaigners at Excluded UK, are they optimistic that there might be any positive resolution to this, or is it pretty much done and dusted. There's a sort of fait accompli, as it were.
There's absolutely no sign whatsoever in the most recent statement of the government anything's changing. And I think it does look like the Chancellor's digging his heels in. I mean, what they're saying is, you know, we can't support everyone, but we need to protect people from fraud. You know, we supported a £350 billion package of support, which is a lot of money by any reckoning. It's a difficult one. I know Labour, Ed Miliband, who's the Shadow Business Secretary, said that, you know, he says basically it's wrong economically to see entrepreneurship dashed in this way. He's issued a statement saying it's wrong. And we do have MPs and campaigners. Gina Miller, there's John Cordwell, who's a respected entrepreneur, who's campaigning on behalf of the excluded. But to be completely honest with you, there's no sign whatsoever that the government is changing its position. And these people are continuing to suffer hardship. And some of the stories are absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, there have been stories of people having to sell possessions, sell their homes, basically having to go without, and their children going without. So this is a situation where we won't, in all probability, come out of this pandemic as quickly as many people hope. And it's a long-term societal problem. So the question is, can we allow a situation where all these people are left behind? And on the back of that, we have long-term issues around their financial well-being. But there's no indication at this stage that the government is going to change its position in any shape.
Yeah, just the sheer number of people who are affected by this is quite striking, isn't it? But as you say, each of those numbers is a person, a family who's livelihood is threatened, and you know, the emotional hardship that comes with that. Greg, thank you very much for that. That is fascinating stuff, and I'll be reading this weekend's edition with interest to find out to hear the full report. So yes, as I say, it will be in there'll be a full special report by Greg in this week's edition. So do pick up a copy if you can. We're going to move on now to this week's guest. So let's hear a little bit about what they have to say. So I'm pleased to be chatting with today's guest, who is Lord Victor Adebowale, the chair of the NHS Confederation. Brought up and educated in Wakefield, he's had a fascinating career which saw him become a leading figure in the housing association movement. For two decades, he was the chief executive of Turning Point, the social enterprise organisation that provides health and care services across England. He was made a CBE in 2000 for services to the Labour government's New Deal and to unemployed and young homeless people, and he was appointed as one of the first people's peers in 2001, becoming a crossbench member of the Lords. His role at the NHS Confederation, which represents the organisations that plan, commission and provide NHS services, started last year just as the country was heading into lockdown. So it's been no small task giving those organisations a voice in recent months. So, Victor, it's great to have you on today. How are you?
Hi, I'm all right. Thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
Likewise, thank you for coming on. So I've got loads to ask you about, because you've had a fascinating career and the work you're doing at the moment is so interesting. But I thought I'd just go back to your roots in Yorkshire just briefly, because obviously you're the son of Nigerian parents and you grew up in Wakefield. That was, you know, what set you on the path to the career you now have. Was that a period you look back fondly on? Did that sort of shape the person that you later became?
I'm very proud of being a Yorkshireman. I love Yorkshire, and I like Yorkshire people, and they are different. And I learned a lot from my past. It wasn't all strawberries and cream. We didn't have a lot of money. In fact, we had no money at all. And my mum brought up, you know, four kids on pretty much a nurse's salary, which is no mean feat. But, you know, what don't kill you makes you stronger, as they say. And I've been blessed with both, resilience and luck, to be honest.
Yeah, well, you've got to have a bit of both, haven't you, to succeed in this in this world.
Self-doubt and ambition.
Yeah, absolutely. So, without going into a huge amount of detail about all your career, you've done a huge number of interesting things. What made you decide to take on your current role as chair of the NHS Confederation, and also for our listeners who don't understand sort of fully what the organisation does, can you just sort of explain explain how it works and what attracted you to it?
Yeah. So basically, the NHS Confederation is the organisation that represents all players in the health and social care system. So we represent your local hospital, your local GP, your local mental health trust, your local community trust, your local voluntary sector organisation. Basically, all those people providing health and social care have leaders running those organisations, and we represent them. And it's just a really exciting opportunity to help shape the future of health and social care. And so I couldn't say no. And, you know, I've been a chief exec of something for, 20 odd years? Well, longer than that, actually, more like 35 years. And it just felt right to take a break from being the chief exec for a while and perhaps be the chair, you know, and support the chief exec. And that's what I decided to do. And I was lucky enough to apply for the job and get it. And I'm enjoying it immensely, actually. I really enjoy the work. It's challenging because there's a lot to do in health and social care, as you no doubt figured. And I joined at a particularly challenging time, just as the pandemic was starting to bite. So we've had a challenge to both manage the present crisis, which I think my members have done incredibly well. I mean, our health and social care members have pulled this country through one of the biggest crises since the Second World War, but to focus on the future as well, because it's the future that will create health and wealth for all of us, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it must have been a very different experience to what you were initially expecting, because you joined in April, didn't you, just as sort of lockdown was starting to bite and the pressures on the NHS were really starting to ramp up.
Yes it was I mean, to me, you know, if you think about it, you know, I have worked for lots of organizations in the public sector, and if you do work for those organisations, both in the public and not for dividend sector, you know, you have to deal with crises because they happen. And so I had thought about the consequences of the pandemic on my members, on our members, and I kind of felt ready to take on the challenge. And, you know, it beholds me to be no less impactful than our members. So, you know, we had to pull ourselves together, operate in a different way, get virtual, as they say, but also stay in touch with our members to work out what it is that we can do for them that will add value. And that's what we've done. And that's what the team's done. And they've done an amazing job. I mean, the Confed team, people have worked 24/7. They've not taken holidays. They've worked as hard as our members. And I mean, they're taking holidays now because I think you have to. But, you know, they've worked very, very hard to make sure our members are represented.
Yeah. And, I mean, I guess it's not disputed, is it, by anyone, that the NHS and the people who work for it have performed heroically over the past year. And obviously that includes the organisations that the Confederation represents. Do you think the events of the last year will be a bit of a turning point in terms of how the NHS is sort of is perceived, not just by the country, but by, you know, the people who decide its future? Because obviously there's, you know, it's very obvious that in the last 10 years there's been a lot of financial pressure on NHS trusts, and they've been trying to do more with less. And, you know, there's an argument, I suppose, the austerity has left them a bit less able to cope with some aspects of the pandemic. Is might that change going forward?
I think that the question, look, the NHS has done, as I said, a remarkable job. We went into this pandemic, you know, with about 100,000 vacancies. So it wasn't as though we went into the pandemic, you know, fully staffed. We'd already asked the government for more money for capital because our hospitals needed rebuilding, and we needed to maintain the performance on elective care, you know, surgery. And so we went into this pandemic, you know, not in the best of shape, and we're coming out of it having achieved a remarkable things with not a lot. And that's because we've pushed social health and social care staff to the very limit of their capabilities. So I think the public appreciate that and expect politicians to reflect on that. And we have to learn. We've had over 121,000 people die. We owe it to those people to learn from those deaths. And it seems to me that going forward, policymakers have to work with the NHS to ensure that we have a proper population health system, that we have proper funding, that we can fill those vacancies, that we can work differently using technology, and that we can reduce what has been called the inverse care law, and the law that states that those people in health and social care the most tend to get it the least, because that costs us all. So, and the pandemic has really shown that in very stark relief. So I think the NHS has proven its worth. It's proven what a health system free at the point of contact can be and should be in a time of crisis. But there's more we need to do. We have to learn from this crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine you'll be called upon to, you know, put forward your view on what the lessons we ought to be learning are. I mean, I guess it's, you know, we're still in the pandemic, aren't we? It's not like it's over. But are there sort of main takeaways that you've gleaned that you'll be trying to impress upon the powers that be when they come to decide these things?
Well, I mean, to be honest, we're making our views heard, whether that's for them or not, because I think it's our duty to. But we wrote to the Prime Minister recently setting out the need for a very cautious approach to getting back to what people might call normal, but I hopefully will be better than normal, which I'm glad to say he's taken up the calls that we've made. We've set out what needs to happen in terms of getting the show on the road for the NHS, which means resolving some of the funding issues, some of the backlog issues, not expecting the things to get back to normal instantly. We have a backlog of elective care of 4.5 million people, and that has differential impacts depending on where you are in the poverty and equity curve. So we have to pay attention to that. And we've called for more funding for social care, because the health and social care system, as we've seen throughout this pandemic, work together. Unless they work together, then everybody's in trouble. So we've called for a reset on social care, so that people can get the social care that they need in time of crisis. I'd like to think that the Prime Minister is listening to us. Certainly, the indications are that he is. We have a white paper coming, legislation coming, which will consolidate some of the things that my members have been working on for some time now, like integrated care systems and primary care networks. And it's primary care networks that have delivered the vaccines that we're all taking. So we've been very clear about what the lessons need to be, and we're very clear about what needs to happen next in order that we can get the NHS and social care system back on its feet and facing the future with confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned that the backlogs that will have built up in elective care. I mean, that's going to take quite some overcoming, isn't it? Because it's been a year that people haven't been able to get certain types of treatments or have had to wait a long time for it. I mean, how big an issue is that for the organisations that you represent?
Well, I think, obviously it's a massive issue for them, because nobody wants to leave people in pain or in challenging circumstances. But I think, to be fair to our members, they've really worked hard, both before the pandemic and during the pandemic, to deliver as much elective provision as they can in partnership with our colleagues in the independent sector. But it's not just the acute care, it's also the mental health challenge. And we reckon that we've got about 10 million additional cases, mental health cases, a direct result of the pandemic, and that has to be dealt with too. So both in terms of acute care and elective surgery, there's a challenge, but in the mental health challenge, I think is just as challenging. We have to respond to the massive backlog in mental health, both in children and in adults, that we're going to have to face, and that's going to require investment as well as new ways of delivering interventions across the piece.
Yeah, you alluded to it earlier, talking about the inverse care law, that people who require the most care get it the least. And I guess that goes back to that harks back to some interesting comments you made last year at a conference organised by the Yorkshire and Humber Academic Health Science Network about the sort of corrosive effect of health inequalities on different parts of the country. And you said we have maybe 2 years to get this right before it's hardwired into a generation to come. We can't afford to waste time. We have to move. We have to move now, and we have to move collectively on the issue of health inequality. I mean, do you get the sense that there's an appetite there, sort of locally and nationally, to do that? Because you hear a lot about levelling up, don't you? But I guess maybe health inequalities is not always sort of paramount when people are talking about those kind of inequalities.
Yes, you're probably going to hear a dog barking in the background speaking. he likes to get in there. I think the issue is this. The pandemic has really put a red line around the health inequalities. We know that people on the front line, the people with the least financial resource, have really suffered during the pandemic, but they've also stepped up to save our lives, actually, and to care for us. So we know that that's a challenge. We also know that minority ethnic groups that often are overrepresented in poor areas doing poorly paid frontline work also have suffered disproportionately during the pandemic. All those are examples of the inequity and inequality that I refer to. You ask me whether there's an appetite. Absolutely. Amongst my members, it's in the top five issues of their concern, whether they are a primary care network or an integrated care system or an acute trust, mental health or community trust. They are all saying, actually, this is an issue we have to deal with. And the reason why they're saying it is because you can't have, it's not sustainable to have a health and care system that has people with differential life expectancy, depending on where they live. And it's not just life expectancy, it's active life expectancy. So, people in Hull, for instance, they have a life expectancy of 78 for men and 80.2 for women, compared with 79.6 years, which matters. The 2 years of life is, and 83.2 years nationally. And that's a problem, because your active life expectancy is also reduced. So you start getting multiple issues, in your 50s instead of in your 70s. And then you're in and out of hospital more. And that, so it's not just morally unacceptable and not why the NHS was established. It's also economically and operationally unsustainable. So we have to tackle it. It's unreasonable and irrational for us to have that kind of differential in life expectancy and active life expectancy across the country and within regions. Now, some of that isn't all down to health. And as Michael Marmot, a renowned epidemiologist, has pointed out, a lot of these issues are related to housing, jobs, transport, etc. But health has a big part to play in ensuring that it actually works to reverse the inverse care law and not to exacerbate it. And I know that my members are really focused on what they can do to move the needle in that area. And I talk about it with them every time we have conversations. So they are committed. And I think the government is as well. I don't think that the red wall and all and levelling up, that's what it means. If it doesn't mean levelling up health, then there is no health. There is no wealth without health. So it's not either or, it's and.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an interesting analogy that was made to me about if you take the East Coast main line out of London and all the various stops on the East Coast main line, I think obviously in London, life expectancy is relatively good. And then in the southeast, it's relatively good. But as you get up into the Midlands and Yorkshire, the life expectancy then declines again. I think in Doncaster, I think it goes up a bit in York because, York is that bit more affluent, but then it sort of starts going down again. So I guess it just gives an idea about the regional nature of it. But I mean, as you say, it's so multifaceted, isn't it? As an issue. And when I think about how you begin to tackle an issue that's so sort of all-consuming. It almost makes my head spin thinking about what you try and tackle first. I mean, is it a case that you have to tackle it from several different directions, and that's how you ultimately...
I think Yes, I think our members are very, very clear about this. I think it can be tackled, and it has, and it is being tackled, and the new population health structures that have been established for a while now, integrated care systems, are designed to do just that, to look across the piece at how health can be brought together to ensure that people get equitable health, i.e. the healthcare that they need, where they need it. And I think that they're focused on that. But also the NHS is working in partnership with local government, and local government has impact in other areas like transport, housing, and work. So I think together there is the potential for us to start creating and scenarios that improve health and social care outcomes for everyone, but particularly for those people at the sharp end. And if you look at it like that, yeah, you could argue these problems are wicked problems, i.e. they've never been solved in one leap throughout the history of the health and social care movement, but there've been rapid steps forward, you know, from the creation of the NHS itself in 1948, right through to the, you know, creation of NHS trusts and the primary care and primary health care. There's been public health. So all these things have been steps forward. And the next big step forward, I think, is, you know, public health by design, population health by design, and how we work with our partners in local government to deliver that single points of contact and healthcare for all. That's the point. So every policy being measured by its ability to improve people's health, as opposed to being neutral or indeed backwards in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Explain the concept of population health, because I think you mentioned that a couple of times and people may not quite understand what that means. It means something quite specific, doesn't it, in terms of sort of a healthcare concept?
Yeah, well, it means what it says on the tin, really. It means looking at a population rather than individuals in that population, and designing a healthcare intervention that actually moves everyone up rather than just some people up. That's basically what it's about. Put simply, it's about ensuring that your area where you live, you know, in the case of Yorkshire and Humberside or Sheffield, or has a health an ICS system, West Yorkshire being a good example, that actually looks across the piece and looks at how they can work together, not just hospitals, but hospitals working with primary care working with community services, and local government working with all of them to present, to move the health of the population up, because we know if we can do that, everybody benefits. That's basically what it means.
Yeah, and so it is happening already to some extent, but you'd like to see that agenda go further.
Absolutely, it is happening. It's starting to happen. It's early days. We're building the infrastructure. We're building the partnerships. We're building the relationships, some of which have been happening over some time now. But you know, I think we have a duty to be optimistic. Those of us that are lucky enough to live in good health, to have jobs and places to live and relationships that are positive and all that good stuff, I think we owe it to be optimistic on behalf of those people who don't. So I am optimistic that we are in the right place at the moment, coming out of a horrendous pandemic. We have the opportunity to learn, take that learning into the future, and start reversing the inverse care law, you know, pushing forward for those people who need it the most.
Fantastic. Well, Victor, that's a good positive note on which to end. And I really hope, I think everyone hopes that that's an aim that can be achieved. And I guess there's going to be all kinds of inquiries out there and, you know, looking back at what the pandemic has taught us. And I think if that aim could come out of everything that we've experienced in the last year, it would be, it would be a real silver lining. So thank you for speaking to us, Victor. And all the best, and no worries at all. And we'll see you next time. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Pod's Own Country, the Yorkshire Post's political podcast. I've been Rob Parsons, the Yorkshire Post's political editor, and you can find this podcast wherever you usually find your podcasts, whether that's Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, Google, or iTunes. And we would love it if you could leave us a review, share our links on Twitter, or tell your friends. So, Jevy will be back next week, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
This weekend at Augusta, it's the Masters. And with 50% off a Now Sports membership, you can catch every.
Oh,
watch all 4 days of the Masters live. With 50% off a Now Sports membership for 3 months, bringing you all 11 Sky Sports channels. Join in at nowtv.com. 18 plus, streamed via internet. Offer ends 2nd of May. Standard pricing after 3 months.